I have Kat here with me today. Kat, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And so I'd like to, the goal here today is to perhaps point some of the listeners to their non-dual nature. But before we do, why don't you give us a little background, intellectual, spiritual, emotional. You have a canvas, paint us a little picture.
All right, let's see what comes out this time. I've been just a very normal person most of my life. I'm almost 50. And for the first 30 years, I was trying to self-improve, self-optimize, self-realize spiritually also myself. And I did lots of various professional things, had normal jobs, moved around, got married, got divorced, all that stuff. And in my 30s, I sort of got hit by what we could call depression. But basically, it was my sense of not being good enough for something vague. I was just like this vague feeling of not being good enough. It really caught up to me and it catapulted me into this complete self-help addiction. So I was reading all this self-help stuff and trying to figure out what was wrong with me and how I could fix it. I didn't know what was wrong with me and I didn't know how to fix it and sort of fed each other. And all of this self-help, at some point, I ended up with Byron Katie's work. And I went to one of her schools for the work and I read a lot of that. And that didn't do it for me either, but that pointed me at some point to what's called non-duality. And I started reading all this non-dual writing from Tony Parsons to John Wheeler to Rupert Spira, all the various authors, some of whom are now actually very well known, became a non-duality press at that time. It was called Best Customer of All Time, I think. And was completely, utterly frustrated because I knew that something there was the truth and was worth pursuing whatever it took. And at the same time, I understood next to nothing. It was gibberish. It was abstract. I mean, these people were saying there is no separate self. There is no separation. Reality is one indivisible whole. And you already are. You already know that. You're just seeking for something that you already know and already are. And this drove me totally nuts. But at the same time, I just wanted more and more of it. So that's all through my 30s. I was in this frustration, you know, seeking, seeking, seeking. And then I'd like to give you some sort of really neat answer of what happened next. But over the next couple of years, it just, the sense of a separate self fell apart or dissolved or broke away. I was still doing normal work and I was continuing to do that. And it's only recently, so in the past 3 to 5 years, that I even felt interested in sharing this with others. And at first it took the form of coaching because I was in the whole organizational development
area. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say you were in organizational and leadership development,
yeah,
right?
For, yeah, exactly.
20-plus years or so. Okay.
Yeah, and so that's what I was still doing when this sort of came through also in the work area. And I decided to become a coach basically for leadership from a non-dual perspective. And I called it selfless leadership. And that was very successful, but at a certain point it stopped. I was no longer interested in doing that and became more interested in really sharing directly what it means to see no self and how that is even possible. And that has just become more and more one-pointed in the last year or so. It's the only thing I'm interested in. But if it disappears tomorrow, that's fine too. I'll go do something else, maybe herd sheep or something like that.
Sure. I mean, once you recognize your nature, everything's okay. Even when it isn't, it's okay.
Yes.
Well, great. Let's maybe start picking that apart. So why is it so frustrating for people that enter this field who are tending to seek something, usually healing or transformation or some kind of spiritual experience? Starting from the self,
yeah,
the,
Yeah, that's where it all starts. That's where the whole thing starts. So until we believe we are a separate person, we're free. And as a small child, we were free until our culture managed to make us believe that we are a separate self who has to control and develop their life. We're free. And seekers come to this believing they are separate selves. So I believe I am a person, I'm defective in some way, and this search, this thing I'm looking for, is going to make me a better person. And that's why it's so frustrating, because the whole message is about there is no one. There is no one who will, there's no seeker, there is nothing to seek, and there's no search, and you will not find anything. So from the perspective of the seeker, this is incredibly frustrating. But only from the perspective of the seeker. And the whole point of non-dual pointing is to get the seeker to drop that limitation on this experience and to see that there is no seeker. So it's almost like poking little holes into this construct that people come to this search with until it becomes clear that the whole thing is porous and even not really there.
Yeah. Yeah, I like you, what you said. You have to start with the self. And for a lot of people in the West, I think the Christian framing may even be useful. The fall from grace. You need a fall from God in order to be separate. And only then can you find your way back to God or paradise or whatever words you want to use to capture this. But yeah, with the self being an illusion, I think that also really ties people up. It's like, well, of course I'm here. Of course I have preferences. I have likes, dislikes. You're talking to me. You're not talking to someone else. And so often my approach is meeting that rather than denying them that self. It's like, no, you're absolutely right. There is a John. It just may not be what it seems. And like you said, it is a smaller part of a bigger or even boundless whole. And yeah, I think what really worked for you were these direct approaches. In Buddhism, classically, we have kind of the gradual realization paths like the Theravada, which uses Vipassana. And then we have some of the direct approaches like Mahamudra and Dzogchen. And it seems like these are the practices that you really related with, where you kind of start with this initial awakening and understand. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if how it worked for me.
Okay.
And I was very, very interested, for example, in Vipassana. For many, many years, I meditated an hour in the morning and an hour when I got home from work, and was very, very convinced.
Striving as
yes,
hard as you could.
Yes, of course. I was the ultimate meditator, and I even had what all of us have at some point where I did the Buddha thing, you know, like, I will sit here until I wake up.
Sure.
Oh, so ridiculous. But that did teach me a lot about what was even more frustrating for this conditioned body, right? So in the meantime, I know that there is no way that we can say this will work for you, or this is the correct path, or this is the way to see this. We just don't know.
Sure.
Because sure. It's everyone's conditioning is different. And I've decided, or not decided, I've found that I end up speaking about that, which is sort of a compromise of my own. It's sort of a middle path of my own. It's there is nothing to do, and you are already that, and it's all already realized. And at the same time, direct inquiry and some form of questioning can clear the mind and bring the mind to the point of falling into that knowing. So
yes,
it's not like there's nothing to do, but it's not like we have to practice for many lifetimes either. Unless that's right. What happens, you know, we don't know. It could be that that's the case.
Right.
And that's the version right. I find myself sharing, knowing full well that I have no clue what someone needs to hear.
Yeah, I think it is a very personal approach. Like you said, we all have been conditioned differently. We each have our own personalities, and we are where we are on our own path. And yeah, maybe for some people, the gradual path works well, and others, perhaps someone with, you know, ADHD, that's just not in the books for them.
Yes, and it's even more obvious, sort of, because we don't choose the path that we're on. So whatever is happening right. is our path because we're on it.
Right, right. Yeah, I have listeners in mind, and they're like, oh, okay, got this non-dual nature. Well, where do I go? Where do I start? Mm. And so, yeah, we can still kind of point them to different resources, which, yes, is a part of their own path. But so let's get into maybe some more practical approaches. So with writing, you're not interacting directly with someone. So are these experiments you've done in the laboratory of your own mind that have helped you, and you're just bringing them into the world to see who connects, who relates? How do you take this approach with writing?
Well, the books that I wrote are based on the work that I did. And my third book is called Seeing No Self, which is actually the practical inquiry guideline, so to speak, that I worked with people over 3 years to inquiry via one-on-one conversations and also via chat. And this really helped me refine, okay, this seems to work for many people with sort of a current, you know, mindset of our times, who come to this seeking non-dual recognition. And it's a combination of the neti-neti type of meditation where you question, you know, what am I not? Am I the body? Am I my thoughts? Am I this yeah. sense of self? So you go through that. And it's also the...
kind of a deconstruction.
Yeah. So it's a deconstruction, a subtraction, systematic. Very systematic. And there's the other side of it, which is the awareness meditation, which is sort of being with what is. And I found that the mix of those two approaches seems to support many people in seeing this completely. Because what often happens is that some people get stuck in the I'm no self and there is nothing, and it's sort of nihilistic emptiness. And others get stuck in this more, I would say almost from a Christian background, you know, it's all God, it's all awareness, yes. and I am that, you know, and you have a self trying to believe they're God. And
yeah, kind of a spiritual bypassing.
Exactly. And both are unavoidable, maybe, depending on what is going sure. on. But I found that the combination of those two seems to sometimes solve for that. So the approach that I use for inquiry is based on that experience with many, many people. And now I write on Substack, I try to write about what I observe in my own direct experience. So simply the way I see it now, again, knowing that A, it's impossible to express really, and B, sure. I will be misguiding some people, speaking directly to some and others won't know what to do with that. And that's fine. Sure. You know, this is just my expression and, you know, take it or leave
it's
it.
Kind of Zen poetry.
Yeah, yeah. But I do try to, my character is sort of, I tend to want to be very practical and helpful. So I'm not that much into the flowery poetry sure. stuff.
Sure.
But that's just me. That's the type of character in this body.
Yeah. No, I really, just looking through your work, I really appreciate your kind of grounded secular approach. I think it's accessible to many people in the West. So, yeah, important work. Kind of wanted to get your voice elevated.
Interestingly, it's also very accessible to people in the East.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the whole world has kind of moved towards an individualistic kind of society.
Yeah, and many people in the East have heard this in their culture for so long that they can't hear it anymore. Mm.
Sure.
So you have to kind of bring it to them in normal speak for them to be able to hear it again.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I just spent some time, I did a long trek through the Himalayas to Tibet, and it was interesting seeing the culture kind of split. All the young people were leaving the villages, and they have smartphones. They're very connected with Western culture, and there is this huge divide in their parents and grandparents, their belief systems, their way of life, and everything. And so, yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting if what you're saying applies to each of those generations, or if it's just kind of the younger generations hearing those stories and not really taking them in or needing a fresh language.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the location, how far, you know, how much of the younger generations are already sort of, they want nothing to do with the older traditions because they are, feel stifling and unmodern and all those things. And I think that's been going on for the last two or three generations already, maybe even longer. Sure. In some areas. With, strangely, like in traditions where there's Hinduism and based on, you know, there's very much closeness to Advaita Vedanta and this non-dual insight, but it's completely pushed away because that's religion in their eyes. So they want nothing to do with
it. Right. Yeah, I see that in all the world's wisdom traditions. I think you can find some of this non-dual wisdom in all of them, but we're allergic to the superstition and the dogma that has really taken over.
But that's what I see as the good thing about, or the helpful thing about non-dual inquiry specifically, is that it really operates from skepticism. So it asks you to not believe anything at all. In fact, as soon as you believe something, it won't work.
Right. Yeah, I love that. I mean, that's really why I fell in love with Buddhism or the Buddha's teachings. I come from a Mormon background. I'm in Utah, Salt Lake City, so kind of the Mormon capital. And yeah, very early I questioned the belief system, and it was kind of this prepackaged belief system, like, here you go, take all of this. And it's like, wait, no, I have questions. And you're discouraged to really ask questions. And so, yeah, in my own search, when I have someone telling me to actually question them and to seek it and know it for myself, like, oh, okay, that's, yeah, I can do that. So yeah, skepticism is not only allowed, it's encouraged.
Yes.
With this kind of inquiry.
Yes, and weirdly, although we say we want skepticism and we don't want a belief system, most of us have never learned how to question. So we've been taught which questions to ask, and then we've been taught the answers to the questions that we're supposed to ask. That's our whole schooling, our whole education.
So can you expand on that some more?
Yeah, so even when we learned philosophy, if we had any, you know, maybe part of English lit or whatever in high school, we were told what the questions were. I mean, very rarely would someone say, look, find your own questions to this topic.
So some of these questions, give me some examples, like the big, who am I?
Who am I? What is the meaning of life?
Meaning...
Yeah, why are we here? What does death mean? all of these things. How should I live? The big one. Where does good, our sense of right and wrong come from? What is the truth?
Yes. Yes.
Those are the big ones. And even when we did study those, which was either in a religious context or if it was at school non-religious, it was in a philosophical, historical context, we were told what big thinkers thought about that and maybe also what type of questions they asked. But we were never taught the Socratic method itself, for example. How do I, for myself, find out what is true?
Yes. Oh, I relate so deeply with that. That is why I am so in love with the philosopher Karl Popper. I don't know if you're familiar yes. with his work.
Yes.
But I mean, yes, he says that the question holds the entire frame. So like just a change in the question, the slightest change may give you, you know, an entirely different answer. It won't even look the same. And so...
Yeah,
really look to the questions you're asking, not the answers to those questions.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, with the ones you named, like meaning, I find so many people falling into depression when they leave their faith and it's like, well, what's the meaning to it all mm-hmm. anymore? It's like the owls and the deer, they don't ask what big meaning they have, you know, it's like. And most of us, as we navigate our day, like when I get up, when I go get my coffee, I don't ask what's the big meaning to it. It's like, I like my coffee. I just go and get my coffee. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's great.
And
pointing that out.
Yeah. So the cool thing about non-duality is that it goes even before that. So you say that all the philosophy and especially the psychology and pretty much all religious content is based on what the self should do. And maybe if we go very far, what kind of questions can I ask so that I find the truth for myself?
Right.
Non-duality takes a step back even to that and asks, who is the questioner?
Right.
And then it's... So it
gets under this assumption that we hold at the start.
Yeah, so it kind of blows you open from the back of the head, you know?
Right.
All the rest is maybe blowing up the front of the mind, but non-duality kind of turns it around and blows open the back end. So now you're wide open in both directions.
Yes. Crucial point. It's kind of the Descartes thinking, I think, therefore I am. It's like, wait a second. Let's get even underneath that. Where is this? What is it? What is it like? Can... You find its location, its quality, have a color, size.
Yeah, let's turn it around. I am, therefore I think. And we can chop off the therefore I think. So I am. And what is even that I?
Yeah. So do you want to maybe lead our listeners through a short little pointing out instruction?
Well, I find that incredibly difficult to do into just, you know, in general, because I'm usually the type who something starts with a question or something comes up and then something comes out to speak to that. And I'm not so much of the, let's sit and look at something in general. So maybe there's something that you or that we can do right now, sort of the two of us, and it will be useful for your listeners.
Sure. I mean, like you said, you tend to start with this self. So it is an inquiry. So I don't know if I'm talking to you, Kat, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Where's Kat? I feel like most of our listeners will have the sense that they are behind their eyes somewhere in the middle of their head, kind of looking out at the world or down at their breath or, maybe some may even seem at the edge of experience somewhere. And
yeah, it's always interesting to when you ask someone, where are you? Where are you located? the mind comes up quickly with answers to all of this. So who am I? Well, yeah, I'm such and such a person. Where am I? Well, here, right? I'm sitting on this chair.
Right.
I'm somewhere behind the eyes. So it's really fascinating that there, unless there is already some kind of opening to this, I found that those type of inquiries, they come to you. So, I mean, we've seen our share, I think, of the videos of, you know, teachers telling you, you know, let's sit and let's meditate and let's find who am I or what am I, and let's sort of go there and fall into awareness. Or, and I love those things if they work for people. At the same time, most of us are not there yet. So we are doing this mentally. And even when we're following a meditation or we're following a being aware of awareness exercise, for example, which I also have in my books, don't get me wrong, they're cool. We end up following that with our mind and in thinking. So it's almost like inquiry at some point, it grabs you, it bites you in the behind and pulls you into what it is. Nevertheless, we can start looking at what this mind does. So right now, as people listen to this, there's constant interpretation going on. It's like, oh, that's what they're talking about. Ah, yeah, I know that. Oh, I've heard that before. Oh, no, that makes no sense. Oh, what a strange person. You know, what is she saying? I don't understand this. This is nonsense. Yeah, yeah, she's saying the same thing as such and such. And this goes on all the time. So when you listen to a meditation or an inquiry somewhere, you are doing that too. And it is crucial to be aware of that. Not to stop it, not to try to change it, because it is what the body mind does, but to be aware of it and to know that that is not it. That is you thinking about the exercise, the inquiry, or the meditation. It's totally normal, and it will happen until it doesn't. So it's actually kind of impossible to lead someone through non-dual inquiry.
Yeah, I think I disagree.
Yeah.
But of course, not everyone is going to get it with some pointing out instructions. And I don't know, I found usually have to go through several to get even the smallest glimpse. But where I was headed with that one, once we identify this thing that we think is the self, with, which is exactly what you described, just this mental chatter, this proliferation of thought after thought, just looping and looping. If we can have this thinker or doer or whatever label we want to give it, the manager, the ego, and we say, okay, focus on the breath or something, you know, and pay narrow attention to the breath. And then maybe we shift attention around and say, follow it to where you think you were paying attention from. Like, oh, okay. Yeah. Become curious in it. What is it like? And let them come up with their, it's their own inquiry, their own investigation. And then have a shift again. Oh, okay. Now what is aware of both the breath and this mental chatter? And maybe this might be what we call a mindful witness that we get in Vipassana practice, that piece at the edge that's just kind of observing everything. And that too isn't quite it. It's like, okay, let's shift to become aware of that. Where is its location, its size? What is its qualities? And let's open again to see what is aware of all of that. And there's kind of just this, I don't know, expansive opening. I feel like there's just little tricks or pointers that can help us relax that thinker a bit or allow awareness itself to come forward. In which case, the thinker, you can then see from that greater awareness that it is a much smaller piece And it kind of, I don't know, decenters you. You're now, if only for a glimpse, you're no longer at the center of experience. You're no longer at the edge. It's just everything is arising and being known in its own place. It's like the famous mirror analogy. A mirror reflects everything. It just comes and goes, and there's no real center to it. I feel like those kind of pointers can help the process.
I'm sure they can. I'm absolutely sure that they can, and that they can be helpful. Just as mindfulness can calm the mind, various awareness practices can open us up to something that seems to be awareness. And at the same time, the way I understand it or I experience it, that is not it. That is a self exploring its own awareness. And I'm not saying that's always the case, but that is very frequently the case. And the people who come to these practices, so it depends how you come to them, but almost everyone is coming from the belief that they are a separate person who can do things. And what these practices then are heard as is, oh, I can do things with my mind or with my awareness and go into expansion and contraction. And again, I'm not saying that's wrong or detrimental at all. Please don't misunderstand. They can be super helpful. But if we're talking about seeing no self, that is not it, the way I have come to experience it.
Yeah, well, I think it's the non-duality, right? First, we can go either way. We can start with the particular and then move to the transcendent, or we can start with open awareness and come into the particular. But experiencing self is this ocean of awareness that is not separate from the waves, right?
Yeah.
And it's not one point in it. It's not one. There might be a part that is doing the investigation, but like you said, that is not it.
Yeah.
The whole of experience, the awareness, the open, unbound, unborn, clear aspect arising as these particular ethereal changing experiences.
Yeah, it's indivisible. So it.
Right.
That's just my experience also with guiding many people, that this, the form of the awareness exercises, if there hasn't been this subtraction process first, I am not the doer, I am not the volitional entity, I am not the one making this happen, then any practice or any exercise is usurped by the self immediately. And again, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with it. That's just the way it happens. And they can be very helpful. I did many of those many, many years, and many people have also. And the seeing of no self, or the realization of the non-dual essence of this, seems to require something more fundamental, more... It doesn't require anything at all. That's the requirement, that nothing happens.
It is. It's the base. It's just this.
So it's more of a recognition of what is already the case. And I found that just many of these things distract people from that, because they start chasing, how do I expand my awareness? And how do I get to all these different tricks? And that becomes the goal.
Sure. Reminds me of a famous Zen master. Student asked him what it's like to be enlightened, and he replied, "When I'm sad, I cry. When I'm hungry, I eat.
Yeah.
When I'm happy, I smile." It's simple. It's not this big wow that a lot of people are searching for. The extraordinary is in the ordinary all the time.
Yeah, but so the reason I keep talking about no self so much is because to me that's the crux of it. You can cry when you cry thinking you are a separate self, or you can cry when you cry knowing that there is no self. And that is a crucial, the quality of the crying, the quality of the experience of the crying is different. It's free. Whereas before it was tense.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a peace and equanimity to it. With your language, I agree. It is the crux of spiritual practice is recognizing emptiness, this selfless, interconnected nature. It just, in the way you speak about it, it seems to emphasize the transcendent side more than the other half. It's like, well, there are still people in the world. There still is this computer in front of me, this phone by my side. And when it comes to navigating the world, what matters so much to us is this relational side of things.
Absolutely.
Our relationships really, on our deathbed, when we're looking back, it's like, that's what mattered, is how I showed up to my loved ones, my friends, my spouse, my kids. And when we leave this self behind and focus on this transcendent aspect, we don't necessarily grow up. We don't know where John has some blocks or some blind spots. And so I think it's really important that, yeah, at the same, we keep one hand in each at all times. It's like, yes, there is no self here. And when I'm crying, there is this, there's no separation from it. I'm experiencing that fully and intimately. It is all of me in some sense. But yeah, I just worry about the self being left behind, a healthy sense of self, if that makes sense.
On the one hand, it does. On the other hand, there is no self to be left behind. So, I mean, what from my experience, what occurs is that the distance, there is no distancing, because the distance between what is and our interpretation of it is the self. So when that becomes transparent, it's just this full-on reality, full-on immersion. So weirdly, ultimate transcendence leads to ultimate immersion. It kind of turns inside out, because there's no me concept. I mean, there is a me concept, but there's no belief in that keeping reality separate from me. So the crying is even more crying, because it is exactly what is. And there's no me apart from that going, why am I crying? You know, is this the right crying? Is it loud enough? Is it soft enough? It's just full on crying.
Yeah, totally. We get out of our own way. I mean, and that's one of the great joys and levels of peace that come from this ultimate recognition. And again, just think of how many very well-known spiritual teachers have committed malpractices, and they have recognized this ultimate nature and have deep levels of practice and realization. It's that alone is just, it's not enough. People say, yes, compassion is the natural response once the self dissolves. You know, I see you here in front of me. And even that language is wrong, because it's, you are me in this moment. This is what is. And there is no space here. You know, I can try to turn attention around and look, and again, it just blasts wide open, and I'm walking around with the world on my head, to use Harding's language. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's important to actually build, we wear different hats. We just can't go operating in the world without a self. And to deny it and ignore it and pretend we don't have a self in a relative sense is going to cause problems. You and I both operate every day of our lives wearing different masks, different hats. Is this our ultimate nature? No, absolutely not. But each of these roles and masks defines some kind of parameter. You know, that's what our concepts do. They give us boxes that we then put into relation with other things. And without this interrelation, we're just a monistic oblivion. There's no, we don't get the juice. So this other relative side really brings that relational piece into play. And so if we're not examining what our self is and what it is in this certain role as a partner, as a teacher, as a employee, employer, you know, we're missing something vital here.
So I think we have to go back and define what we mean by self. Because
sure. Small self.
Small self. Because to me, there is a body, a physical body with a neuropsychology and pattern behavior.
Totally.
So you could say that is the self that people see. It's the body mind that does specific things. This body mind may be conditioned to care about morality, to care about relationships, to want to be more spiritual, more compassionate. None of that, to me, is a separate self. That is a conditioned body mind unfolding the way it unfolds, influenced by culture, etc., and the many roles and the many characters it plays in this culture of different bodies interacting. To me, the self is the idea of a separate entity that controls this body mind. So the me that owns this life and steers it in some form. So that can determine what to do, determine that it wants to be interested in spirituality, for example, and pursue that path. And that does not exist as I see it. There is no such entity. There's no controlling entity in this body mind. So if the question is we need to examine, you know, continue to examine ourselves and to evolve spiritually, if you will, or be good people and develop that. Yes, that is a body-mind characteristic that is present, or in some people it's not present, but that is not a self. That's the way
I see it. No, I can relate to that, absolutely. I mean, you're essentially coming at this emptiness from a different angle, which is this idea that a lot of people have, which is that I, this self, have agency or will.
Yeah.
And I get to determine my actions. And it's like, well, let's step back. I didn't pick my genes. I didn't pick my family. I didn't pick my language, which couches my belief systems. I didn't choose any of this. I don't choose what thought I have next. I don't choose the sensory experiences I have. So, yes, in the Eastern frame, we can think of it as karma. We can think of it as causality in the West. But we are not the authors of our lives. Absolutely. And so, yes, when I talk about exploring the self, and even that can be too broad, we can talk specifically about, you know, some of us have deep traumas from childhood, and these traumatic patterns can be triggered at certain times in, say, relationships. And so, yes, examining them through a method, even like Vipassana or combining that with psychotherapy, can be very useful.
Absolutely.
And we just open our awareness to our own causes and conditions. And what's interesting is when we do have some base or practice or direct understanding of our non-dual nature. Yes, our morality, if you'll want to call it that, just the way we tend to move forward, is in a compassionate way, seeing this interconnection of the whole and in our relationships. So yeah, I agree with all that. I guess there is less difference than I thought. It's more of a tendency in being careful with listeners or people I speak with to not spiritually bypass our everyday lives. How does John show up in the world and in relationship?
Yeah, and the cool thing about that is if we are the type, let's say, who bypasses, nothing you or I say, no matter how carefully, will stop that from happening. Because that is the conditioning of that person to currently, for whatever reason, bypass. And the other way around, if you are currently, the body-mind is in the situation where it is confronting these things, following these things, inquiring, wanting to do these practices, then bypassing will not happen. And of course, that doesn't mean that we stop doing anything or stop speaking to listeners in a useful way. But just, I find it helpful to know that what happens just unfolds. And it's because my experience is that we immediately feel this responsibility, you know, that I've got to do this right. I have to not bypass. I have to ensure I don't bypass. And immediately we're back into this guilt tripping ourselves.
Shame and all the rest.
And that's why I don't talk about those things that much, because whatever the body mind does is in that sense, almost none of your business. And yes, when this is clearly seen, that sort of resolves on its own. And you might find yourself meditating for many, many hours effortlessly, because it is just what occurs then. Equally, some people find nothing changes at all. And, you know, they just continue with their lives. Don't even talk about this. Don't even want to inquire further. It's just done. Yeah, that was just what came up for me when you said that about bypassing.
Yeah, it was interesting that you said nothing that you or I say will have an impact.
No, and that's like, wrong. If I said that's too simplistic. What I mean is that, of course, these variables we're throwing into the universe have effects.
Exactly. Right.
But there's a difference between thinking that if I tell people not to buy, you know, to watch out for bypassing, then they will automatically, they will listen to me and they will.
Sure.
So that's more the type of causal thinking I'm referring to, which is how most of us operate most of the time. We think that if we, you know, tell someone, don't do that, or tell ourselves, stop it, then that should happen, right? And then it doesn't, and we feel bad.
Right. For me, on this conditional level, if we have these unhealthy conditions that lead to shame or any harmful pattern, what we would like to do is condition a compassionate response. So even when we fall into a pattern of shame or anger, it's like, oh, that's okay, sweetheart, you know, like, that's, of course that's going to happen. That is our conditioning. And, you know, and just recognizing that. And right there, and just that simple allowance, there is a compassionate response that is being conditioned. So I think it is important that we still work with some kind of new conditioning pattern. We don't, it's, yes, we can set them up to do their own inquiry, but yeah, humans need support. We need help from one another. We need partners to reflect things at us.
Yeah, and what I add to that is, don't beat yourself up if that is not happening for you. If you cannot meet yourself with a compassionate response, that's not because you're failing at some sort of practice. It's because that's just what's occurring. because there exactly. is no yeah. one making kind of. Compassionate responses happen. They either occur or they don't. And that's my only issue with this recommending a specific way to behave, is that it is automatically heard by the self as, now this is personal. What I have to do. Yeah, and if I don't achieve it, there's something wrong with it. In some level, some have that more than others. But we sure. everyone who comes at this from the belief in the separate self, which is pretty much all of us, misreads that. And yeah, that's what I find difficult about recommending, you know, do this, try this, approach it this way. Because whether that approach will happen or not, who knows? All we can do is offer suggestions. And that's why, to me, inquiry
exactly.
and those other practices, it's an offer. It's a suggestion. Try it. You know, maybe it'll work. Maybe it will not.
Invitation.
Yeah.
If it works, great. If not, toss it. No, yeah. no worries.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's more of an attitude that we bring in as teachers, as friends, as it's just this unconditional loving support.
Well, to me, there's no other, you know, there's no other way to approach this because it's just what it is. So.
Right. There's no, I mean, that's the opposite of wisdom. Wisdom is being in alignment with what is. We don't want to kick and scream and fight with
yeah,
what
it just doesn't
is here.
Make sense. So yeah, it's a waste of everything. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Draining
yeah.
on your energy. But again, it's. A lot of us are conditioned to push away the unpleasant,
yeah,
to grasp absolutely. To the pleasant.
And it's always with these, when I speak about these different things, I have my conditioning, you have yours, you know, right. our bodies. So our conditioning determines what worked for us, what we were drawn to, what we enjoy, what we like sharing. And that too is beautiful to see the immense variety in that. There's just so many different ways of pointing to this, of sharing, of things we can do or try. And I always find it difficult when it moves into, you know, there's one better or more direct way or whatever. And that's why I will never say anymore. I mean, I had my phase where I thought that was true. I don't anymore say, you know, everyone should do direct non-dual inquiry. Absolutely not.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's infinite ways, and
yeah.
there has to be, because we're all unique.
Exactly.
I mean, each of our unfoldings are
yeah.
our own. So, yeah. And like we said at the beginning of the podcast, we each have our own conditioning, our own personality, and so... Some people might find the gradual realization great. Others, the direct, great.
Yeah.
Some people, it's art or sports or nature or...
Yes.
You know.
Yes. And the beautiful thing
great.
About it is that the fact that you are alive, that is the path. So you automatically are your own path. You don't have to find it. It
yeah.
is exactly this. So that's what I love about it. You know, you're already on it. You're already... Right in the middle of it.
It's right here, baby.
Yeah, exactly. So don't worry.
Yeah,
no?
yeah.
This is it. This is the path on undoing you in whatever form it takes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that takes off a lot of pressure too, and some of that striving mind that
yeah.
can be so disruptive.
Yes, and that the striving and the frustration are also it. So... You know, if you are striving a lot
right,
and seeking
right.
and you feel frustrated about it, that is your path. That is the path because it's happening.
Right. Right. Classically, yeah. The hindrances, they're not obstacles to overcome. They are
yes.
the path. This is it.
Yeah. But that is so
we
often misheard, right? It's so often misheard as I have to fix all these things. And especially in the West, when we hear these teachings,
right.
it's like, oh, I have to be permanently aware of awareness, you know? I have to meditate all the time. I have to expand into something. And if I'm contracted, I'm in trouble, you know? It's
right.
Everything is heard as a to-do. And
right.
why is there no app for it yet, you know? So I can track my way to it.
Right. Right. Well, all right, we've got a little bit time left. Before we go, why don't you tell me what the biggest struggle, and maybe we've covered it already, but what is the most common struggle you see with people that you've worked with?
I think ultimately it comes down to an inability to trust. Almost that we are allowed to know this. So It's the inability to believe or to trust that, yes, I am this too, or I too am this. Yes, this is it. So there's always this core feeling of, yeah, but, you know, not me, not this poor soul. I don't deserve this. I haven't seen it. I can't recognize it. I can't do what they do. You know, maybe some enlightened teacher somewhere, not me. In whatever form, from very mild to very thick and sticky.
Right.
I'm not deserving.
Do you think that's residual, kind of from our culture, this worthiness that comes from our Christian roots?
Probably. That's a big part of it. But I think it's also the essential aspect of believing you are separate. Because as soon as you, you know, single yourself out of the rest of this, you feel small and vulnerable and undeserving and scared, basically, because you think you're a tiny little thing in this, you know, endless universe.
Right. Scary, isolating, and lonely.
Yeah, yeah. So all of those things are sort of baked into the self operating system. And it is only when that is sort of dissolves that it becomes clear that that was all unnecessary.
So this is making me think about the depression you faced. You said you explored self-help materials, resources endlessly, and found none of it particularly useful. Did you have a sense of a lack of this trust in yourself that you're kind of pointing to? Was that a piece of your depression, or was that something else?
Well, it's an interesting question, because I think the depression itself was this basic feeling of, I'm not good enough. I'll never measure up. I'm not the person I'm supposed to be. So this was very much about me developing myself. And becoming, you know, having all these values that I wanted to be always kind, always compassionate, blah, blah, blah. And I was nowhere near that. So, oh no, I need help. But there was a turning point for me in this direct inquiry part where I remember very clearly, I was convinced that this was very, very difficult to achieve and only for, you know, people like the Buddha or very few realized beings who went through some incredibly difficult ordeal. And there was a clear shift when there was the realization, no, this is all of us, you know, this is here already. It is not something I have to go and get and I'm not worthy of getting.
Right.
But that's the obstacle I see almost all the time, that basic assumption is there that, yeah, you, okay, or, you know, someone else over there, but not me.
Yeah, I would say that is widely spread in people that I meet as well. There is this.
And the opposite way as well, the projection, well, you can't have seen it, you know, because you're still the stupid ego. So how can you pretend to have seen that there is no self? It's the counter projection as well. I'm not deserving, and almost nobody else is deserving. Only these strange, you know, enlightened figures. So it's not seen as something that is our true nature or our birthrights in that sense. That is what we are. It's seen as something difficult, far away, for special people.
Right, right. Well, it is right here, and it is yours.
Yes, it is us.
Well, Kat, thank you. Now you've written three books, correct?
Yeah.
What's your latest book?
Well, the one that's being republished now officially through a publisher is Seeing No Self, which is this sort of manual for self-inquiry, or the way I think it might be helpful to people to try, again, as an offer, as an option.
And where can they find this, my listeners?
It's in all the online bookstores, so it can be pre-ordered. It'll come out beginning of March.
Okay.
And then I'm writing a fourth one.
You can be found.
So.
Oh, great. I love the writing process.
Yes.
Do you enjoy it, or?
Yeah. So the fourth one is a collection of my Substack posts, and I don't know if you know, but these Substack posts, in the sense of my ego, wanted to quit because I get a lot of negative reactions as well. But they just keep
it's
coming.
The nature of the internet.
Yeah. they just keep emerging, and every morning I get up and this post comes out. It's crazy.
A wave out of the ocean.
Yeah, it's like, why, you know? But yeah, okay, here it is, a post. And I enjoy it too, so it's with joy.
Yeah.
But I still find it amazing. I mean, if you would have told me 5 years ago that I would end up writing about this and writing four books, I mean, no way.
Life is mysterious.
Yeah.
I was a corporate attorney at one point.
You were?
So, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so I've taken a turn as well.
Yeah, so we have a similar past. I was one at some point as well. Yeah. Legal counsel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, first 5 years.
Oh, wow. That's funny. All right. Well, listeners, check out Kat's book, and you can follow her on Substack. And it's been a real pleasure. I hope to do it again sometime.
Thank you very much. It was a very cool conversation. I like this. Yeah. Not the easy answers, you know, but the looking also at how things land.
Yeah, really appreciated it. Until next time.